Did you know that 43% of DevOps teams have to rerun their infrastructure deployments more than 4 times? That's like 3 times more than they should. Spacelift shifts your validations left to detect errors earlier, helping your whole team move faster. Learn more at spacelift.io/day-2. That's DAY-TWO. Welcome to Day 2 DevOps, where the DevOps is in the details. I'm Ned Bellavance, and on Day 2 DevOps, we explore those details and how you can learn from the mistakes of others and build a solid DevOps practice on Day 1 and beyond. Normally, Kyler Middleton would be joining me on this journey, but sadly, she was unavailable, so I'm flying solo today. But I'm not totally alone. Joining me today is Mark Boost. He's the CEO and founder of Sivo. And we are going to talk about how the big promise of cloud cost savings has really failed the consumer. Prices haven't gone down, even though they should, as far as I can tell. We'll also talk about how the desire to migrate off the public cloud is a fraught enterprise. Lots of companies are saying that they want to move off the public cloud, but not so many are doing it. And that's because it's super hard. And part of that problem is the lack of interoperability between public cloud providers. It's great for them because it keeps you locked into their platform, but not so great for us. So we'll talk about the Open Cloud Coalition and an effort to make things a little more open when it comes to public cloud. Well, Mark Boost, welcome to Day 2 DevOps. We're very excited to have you here. Why don't you tell the lovely listeners out there a little bit about yourself?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. Really pleased to be on the show. I'm the founder of Sivo and CEO, and I've had a 25-year career as a founder, founded various different technology companies. I originally started out in domain names and web hosting, and you're probably all familiar with a company like GoDaddy. So this was actually launched in the UK as kind of a rival to the GoDaddy-style company. And so it actually grew to become the fifth largest hosting company in the UK, and about 500,000 domain names under management. At the time, the largest company had 2.1 million, so we're about a fifth of the size. And they actually got acquired by GoDaddy. So that business was organically grown. And really, that was my first kind of foray into, you know, technology as a founder. And really from there, I kind of got involved in a few spin-offs. So I launched a company called ServerChoice, which was a data center company. And we started building our own data centers. And then got involved in a connectivity business called AI Networks. And we were putting fiber in the ground in the UK and London area specifically. And some cybersecurity startups as well. And then eventually coming back to my roots in hosting with Sivo, which is really set up to challenge the hyperscalers.
Wow. So you've seen cloud from a bunch of different angles, from that like traditional data center, actual fiber in the ground to web hosting. And now it's sort of an alternative to some of the big public cloud providers out there.
Yeah, definitely. I've kind of seen it all over the years, you know, right back to the early days of hosting some pretty basic servers back in the day, you know, in data centers. And, you know, I used to rack them up myself as well in those early days. And I've still got the, you know, almost the scars from those cage nuts that you yes. used to put into the racks and those kind of things. So, yeah, and I've seen even data center industry evolve over the years, you know, to be a lot more sophisticated than it used to be, because they used to be like almost like, you know, telecoms sort of carrier centers, and they weren't really that sophisticated to be in, you know, the data centers that we have today. You know, the AI focused ones that have liquid cooling and all these kind of things nowadays, it's changed a lot. But it's great to, you know, to be so hands-on in those early days and really see that growth. I'm a great believer that you should be really hands-on with the nuts and bolts to really understand, you know, how things work in that regard. And I think probably in today's age, you know, we're so abstracted away from the physical servers. I mean, you know, sometimes I bump into people, some young people have never seen a data center, never even seen a server, you know, because we're so abstracted.
Right. Yeah. To them, a server is just a couple clicks or a quick script that you run. And I have a server now. And yes, I too remember racking servers. And I specifically remember when someone showed me the special cage nut tool that let you take it in and out without slicing your fingers open. And I was like, oh, you're magic. Thank you.
Yeah, definitely. Some of those servers are pretty heavy as well. So yeah, a few back injuries as well.
Oh, yeah. So that's where we came from. But I'm really curious to hear your opinion on where we are today. Like, where are we with cloud in 2025? What's going right? And what's maybe going a little bit wrong?
I think I mentioned before, I did a keynote not so long ago at one of our Cevo Navigate conferences, which is kind of like our version of reInvent, if you like, where we launch all our new products and things. And it was titled "The Cloud is Broken." Mm. And the reason for that is that I think we've got to a stage where in the original promise of the cloud was flexibility and kind of cost and savings and that kind of scale on demand and all those great benefits. But what was actually promised by Andy Jassy, who's the AWS, well, it's actually the Amazon current CEO, but he used to be the AWS CEO. And I remember back at the first reInvent, he promised that customers love the fact that in the cloud, they get to pay a lower variable expense than they can do on their own. And also he talked about the kind of legacy IT companies at the time, you know, your HPs, your IBMs, Oracles, run into these huge kind of gross margins, 80% margins. So they gave this kind of promise of cloud should be a lot lower cost and flexible than you can do it yourself. And then kind of when you fast forward to where we are today, you know, we've seen gradually over the years, you know, costs go up and up and up and up. And actually, you know, a lot of the surveys now is the biggest problem for customers is this spiraling costs. And I think it's crazy we've got to the stage as well where, you know, companies are having to employ expensive consultants to reduce their bills. You have the whole FinOps kind of software movement of software to try and make sense of these bills. You know, so really that's the whole reason Cevo exists actually, is to bring that simplicity back to cloud, that price transparency, predictable prices, fairer value. And also I think what's happening is a lot of people are now coming off cloud, but for some, I believe, for the wrong reasons, because cloud does offer that scalability on demand. You know, we just talked about it earlier, you don't have to go and buy servers and wait for them to, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks for them to be delivered. Then you have to rack them up yourselves. You know, you have to get all the networking kit, build all the security around it, all those kind of things. And the cloud's a wonderful thing, especially for startups where you can just scale on demand. But I think people are now coming off cloud for the wrong reasons, just for cost, and they're losing that flexibility in the process. So Cevo, you know, we're trying to be that middle ground, really, that you don't have to fully come off cloud because we have that price, the transparency, and we have the lower costs and things, but still with the flexibility in that regard.
I want to come back to the problem of pricing and the cost of the cloud, because there were some big promises made. And I was very involved in some cloud migrations, you know, it's almost 10 years ago now. And they had these cost calculators that made these big promises. You know, you move off your data center and you shut everything down, and now you're saving on administrative costs, you're saving on that overhead. I took all of those calculators with a grain of salt. But how much of this is because when we did the migration, we refused to adopt the newer technologies that the cloud offered, and we just took our VMs and put them in cloud instead?
I think it's partly that, but I think it's partly that there's been so many new services launched. I mean, I've lost count of how many services some of the hyperscalers have, but I guess sometimes they're so easy to consume as well. Sometimes even without your knowledge, you accidentally turn something on and you've got this huge bill for something you didn't realize you'd turned on. But you've got all these as a service products as well. And obviously they're even higher margin than just buying more infrastructure. So before you know it, you're consuming all these as a service products on top of your kind of core infrastructure, you know, database as a service or logs as a service or whatever it might be. And then suddenly your bills are just getting out of control. As your infrastructure is growing, you're producing more logs, you're building bigger databases, and those costs just get more and more bloated. And then you add that to sort of the price increases that are coming anyway. And then also products that traditionally weren't charged. You know, for instance, last year, AWS announced that they're going to charge for IP addresses. And that actually meant that they earned an extra $1 billion of revenue in a single year just from charging for IP addresses. And you can understand the challenges of big public companies like that, because they have to hit their earnings every quarter and will beat their earnings. So they're under pressure. And sometimes we haven't got that organic growth in cloud that we used to have now. So really they're at the point now where they have to kind of pull these levers, you know, which one should we pull this month to kind of hit our target? You know, should we increase prices over here? Should we charge for IP addresses? Should we do this? And I think we're going to see more and more costs go up in the cloud in that sense, because they have to hit these earnings targets.
It's so strange, because the expectation, at least my expectation, would be like, look at storage, for instance. Disks have only gotten bigger and bigger, and storage itself, physical storage, has only gotten cheaper. So why haven't the costs of storage in the cloud also dropped at a commensurate rate? And you have to kind of scratch your head and go, well, maybe there's something shady going on there.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the cloud is sold on cores and RAM, and a lot of the instance sizes, they're still selling it on the same sort of core counts. We know that, you know, CPUs now are having far more cores than they used to. We're looking up to 100 plus cores now in, you know, CPUs from the likes of AMD and things. So you know, that price per core is really going down from a kind of a hardware perspective of acquiring the hardware. So certainly, yeah, like you say, the storage's price should be going down in some respects, but they're not actually increasing the prices. You know, SIVO, we've frozen our prices and you know, we've been transparent in terms of that kind of thing. But we were way cheap to start with. I think we're about 70% less costly than hyperscalers for our on-demand services. And we've given sort of a lot of price promises in that regard as well, of not doing increases.
When I think about cloud and the migration to it, like one of the big benefits that you mentioned, I mean, cost wasn't really a benefit, but big benefits were the scalability and also the programmability of the cloud. The fact that I could take modern tools and programming languages and interact directly with cloud services. I wasn't locked down to using VMware's GUI to accomplish tasks or, you know, God forbid, logging into a terminal and running console commands and stuff. How do we keep that, but move away from these like big public cloud providers?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of benefits, you know, especially as I said in those early days, that I think to move faster was the reason people rushed to the cloud, because these services were available on demand. But maybe now everyone's moved to the cloud and, you know, they might have been living there for a number of years and actually start to look, well, that speed of kind of getting started, that there's not that requirement anymore. I'm already there now. And now I'm just seeing my bills go up and up and up and up without the benefit of that kind of scale. And most companies, you know, we see it ourselves, they don't have dynamic workloads. Most companies are fairly static. I'm sure there are ones that have peaks and troughs, and maybe they're retail, Black Friday, that kind of stuff. But most companies have a fairly stagnant kind of workload. So does it really lend itself to the cloud? And I think, you know, certainly my recommendation would always be that, you know, companies should have a multi-cloud / hybrid cloud strategy. And there's certain things that should definitely live in a cloud. Maybe it should live with a hyperscaler, because they've got a region in a certain area that maybe SIVO doesn't have, or they have a certain product that's very specific that SIVO doesn't have. But I think there's other workloads that lend themselves really well to what SIVO does. There's other workloads that maybe should live on-prem. And I think people are starting to figure this out now, especially when you've got AI coming along, and maybe there's reasons to have data closer to the edge and not have it centralized in that respect. So I think that's driving change. I think the stat came out recently from an IDC survey. It was around 78% of companies, you know, looking to move all of their infrastructure off cloud or part of their infrastructure off cloud. And I think that's the, you know, going back to the cloud is broken. A lot of that, I think, is because of cost reasons. And I think that shouldn't happen, really. I mean, what we should have is that we should have quite a well-priced cloud service. And if we're taking any workloads off, we should be taking them off for a reason of performance or moving it to the edge or specific sovereignty reason or something like that, and not because it was a cost reason, I think. And SIVO's trying to bridge that gap. And I think what we have done as a strategy, I think we're pretty unique in this sense, is that our private cloud solutions offer the same as what we offer in the public clouds. What we use in our public cloud, you can actually buy and deploy it privately, either as a software-only solution, which can be like a VMware replacement, but also we have a hardware appliance that has the same software stack and it uses all the same APIs, and you get our full stack of services in a box, essentially. So we have parity at the public cloud and at the, you know, private cloud level. And I think that's quite unique, because and gives people the flexibility again to say, where should we place our workloads? Is it an AI workload and I do want it nearer the edge for some reason, low latency, something like that? Or do I want it in the cloud because I need more elasticity in that sense?
Are you handcrafting multi-stage pipelines to deploy and manage your infrastructure? I know Kyler is.
Only all the time, deploying EKS, then Kubernetes, then the Kubernetes applications, all with custom glue. I spend hours doing that each week. Everyone's doing that, right, Ned?
Now, based on Spacelift's State of Infrastructure Automation report from this year, you're in good company. Tons of folks are building complex, custom pipelines to deal with their infrastructure, but maybe you don't have to. Spacelift keeps track of all the graphs from your infrastructure as code tools and can even zoom out to understand how those graphs interconnect. Your graph of graphs. You can also enforce policy as code with OPA, detect and remediate drift, and apply consistent controls across your teams and environments.
But Ned, what am I going to do with all this newfound free time?
Get a hobby, I guess. I hear pickling is all the rage. You can start your 14-day free trial at spacelift.io/day-2. That's day-2. And we thank Spacelift. You mentioned the survey and that a bunch of companies are saying, at least in the survey, that they're looking at migrating their workloads. How much of that is posturing, do you think, versus an actual intent and plan to move workloads? Because moving workloads is not a trivial matter.
No, I think it is that more people are looking at it than doing it at the moment. The numbers have actually gone up, though. I've seen some recent surveys, too, since the IDC survey. I think one was about 81% and then more recently 83%. You know, so it seems to be increasing that people are looking at that. But I guess also there's not a lot of solutions out there that allow you to seamlessly move off in the same way you already work. You know, that's the beauty of SIBO. It is in the same way. But if you're trying to move off AWS and find a private cloud solution that offers parity, it's actually very hard, you know, and that migration might be quite a big migration. So that might be why there is the posturing as well, because, you know, people are trying to search for solutions to solve that problem.
Yeah, one of the things that I really wish had happened with the rise of the public cloud providers was an agreement on standards for the various services that they offer.
Yeah.
You know, S3 is a great example. At this point, S3 is almost a universal standard. I think AWS even donated it as an open standard at this point, but there's still, like, I think Azure doesn't support it natively. So there's this lack of interoperability between the various cloud providers. And it's a big sticking point because even if I want to migrate, it's so much more complicated because I don't have this interoperability between the different clouds. So I have to map out the migration. And God forbid, I actually ended up using some of these platform as a service tools that are, you know, bespoke to that cloud. It's going to make that migration that much more complicated. How do we avoid that in the future if we do choose to move to a new platform? Am I just going to end up locked in on another proprietary cloud?
Yeah, I mean, that's the danger, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of work I know going on in Europe, and there's currently an ongoing investigation in the UK as well into hyperscaler monopolies. Mm. A lot of that is around the interoperability and trying to open it up. You know, they have talked about trying to standardize APIs and things like that as well. So we'll have to see what comes out of that because they haven't put forward their final recommendations and things in that regard. But there's definitely a lot more happening in that area, and it may need, you know, regulatory action to be taken to kind of drive change. Because I mean, ultimately, I always think, you know, SIBO's, we're trying to be the most open cloud in that regard. And we believe in the multi-cloud future. And I think the power should be given back to the users, to the consumers of these services. And I think really most people have to just play by the hyperscaler's rules. You know, once you're kind of locked in, it's very hard to get out. And that's by design. Mm-hmm. And they want it to be as proprietary as possible. And being open does not serve to help them. But really, from a consumer's point of view, that's the best thing, you know, choice. It's like, you know, I go to, you know, one coffee shop and I'm not happy with the coffee, I just go to the coffee shop down the road. And most walks of life, you have that choice. But in cloud, you don't.
Yeah. Could you imagine, like, you go to one coffee shop and you don't like the coffee, you go to the next one, and they're like, oh, we don't use that cup. We have our own proprietary cup that you have to buy and use. You can't use the cup that you brought in or whatever weird thing that they do. That's kind of what the clouds are doing. They're like, no, you have to use our weird proprietary coffee cup.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. And I think that's very true. And I think, you know, the way we see it is that we should be judged on things like reliability, performance, customer service, mm-hmm. and not because we've locked someone in and they're trapped and can't get out with, you know, costs that are spiraling out of control. So if we were all judged on those other things, you know, the things that most businesses, like going back to the coffee shop or a restaurant, you're judged on service, the quality of the product, the food, and things like that. And if we offer a great service, then people won't leave. Now, that's the way we look at it. So if we had this open cloud kind of platform, we have to be absolutely on our A game all the time to make sure we retain our customers. But I think that's what businesses should be about, isn't it? That's most industries, is the ones that perform the best keep the most customers. But I don't think that's where we've got to in cloud. It's almost like a lot of people are, especially in the early days, are offered these, you know, huge amounts of free credits to entice them in. They then build all their software around the infrastructure and all the, you know, Terraform code and all the other things that they use, and all the as a service products they might have bought from, you know, proprietary products they've bought from, say, AWS. And then suddenly with the free credits run out 2 years later, it's almost impossible for them to leave in that regard. So I think it's important that we do try and, you know, drive change, because ultimately it's better for the customer to have that choice. Even if it comes to renewal, you know, even that threat of change in provider is going to get them a better price with the current provider if they can ever leave.
Right.
You know, so it can only be good to drive costs down and give choice in that regard.
Yeah, it's funny because when I was working in data centers and we were evaluating different vendors, there was that level of interoperability, at least at the compute level. So if I was looking at an HP server, you know, HP at the time before the split, HP or a Dell server or an IBM server, they were all using x86. They were all using the same basic components underneath. So migrating from one hardware platform to another was no big deal. It was just like, can I back up this server and then restore it on the other hardware? And that got a lot easier over the years. So there was that. I had leverage. I could go to Dell and say, I'm fed up with the way you've designed this iDRAC interface or something, and I'm going to move off to HP because I love their ILO or something, you know, like that. And that would put pressure on them to make the product better or to lower their prices. I don't have that same leverage if I've fully committed to Azure and I'm using Azure Functions and Azure AI and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if I have a question in there. It's just like, we had this and then we let go of it when we moved to the cloud. That makes me a little sad.
Definitely. Well, I remember back in the early days when I started, you know, back in 1999, and the hosting companies that you had at the time, you know, you would just essentially have you design your website, you know, a bunch of HTML files. Maybe you might have the odd CGI script there, you know, Perl script or something, maybe a database or something, a basic database.
Yeah.
But all you did really was you would FTP those files to your preferred cloud provider. It was dead simple. And then if they were having bad downtime or you weren't happy with them, you just take those same files and you sign up for a different account with another provider and you just upload those FTP files. You know, going back to my point before, that meant that that cloud provider, or that wasn't really known as a cloud provider, that hosting provider
right.
was judged on service, reliability, and performance. And if they weren't able to tick those three boxes, they would lose customers. You know, and it was simple to move and almost do it overnight. But now, yeah, with the cloud complexity that we brought in and the way cloud providers have built very much proprietary ways of working, and even down to things like IAM and other products and security and things that, you know, have been built in and networking and all these kind of things to make it as difficult. There's no parity, is there, to move these on a one-to-one basis between cloud providers. So ultimately, I think, you know, there should be more done, because why do we want a situation where the consumer is having the worst experience? If they're not happy, they should be able to leave and have that freedom. And that just doesn't exist. And no, we don't, from a CIBO perspective, you know, we also appreciate that there's a place for hyperscalers. And we're not saying we want everyone's workloads to move to CIBO, but we know certain workloads do lend themselves to CIBO. And we want to be one of the cloud providers in a company's multi-cloud strategy. Mm-hmm. And that's the way we see the future. And multi-cloud, people talking about it, they're the holy grail, you know, one day. But we're so far off of a real, true multi-cloud world where we have that seamless movement between providers. But yeah, I think probably some regulatory kind of action has to be taken. It's not in the best interest for anyone to look at this from a hyperscale perspective.
Yeah, I think we may have discussed on our planning call the Open Cloud Initiative. Can you explain kind of what that is? And does that tie into this problem of lock-in and proprietary solutions?
The Open Cloud Coalition.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, so we are a founder member of the Open Cloud Coalition. There's about 20, 25 members, including Google, actually, they're a member, that are pushing for the cloud to be more open. And a lot of things we are talking about are the interoperability in that way and more transparency and those kind of things. And also, obviously, trying to champion, just make sure for fair practices across licensing and things like that, you know, some of the Microsoft things that they've got kind of tied into their cloud is, again, it's unfair. It's been investigated in the UK by the UK government as well, so the competition authority. So, yeah, I think the work that we're doing there really is just to try and improve that. You know, we're lobbying governments both in Europe. I spent a bit of time in Europe recently in Brussels lobbying, and also at number 10 at Downing Street, you know, the Prime Minister's residence. We were invited to as the Open Cloud Coalition to speak to government about various different things, including sovereignty, interoperability, all these kind of things as well. So we're trying to fight for change. You know, Rome wasn't built in a day. It takes a long time. It's going to take a lot more lobbying and things to actually have that. But I'm very passionate for more, as I said, to it should be about the end user. I think we've always got to bring it back to that, I think, is that it should be about choice and not playing by other people's rules. And that's what I think we're in at the moment. You know, we've had the same with Broadcom, haven't we?
Mm.
Coming in with VMware. And that's another example where, you know, some companies are reliant on that for their whole business. You know, their business was almost VMware. They built on that platform. And then suddenly costs overnight went up, you know, 4x. Sometimes you heard even 8x, 10x. They must have gone straight into the red, some companies, especially small and medium-sized companies, overnight. and they've got nowhere to go, nowhere they can move to quickly. And, you know, potentially businesses ruined, lives ruined, jobs ruined, layoffs, all that kind of stuff. So I think sometimes, you know, some of these bigger companies have to look at themselves, and these sort of unfair practices need to be scrutinized in a way. But also, I think, I suppose I'm putting it out there as well, but we should think really carefully when we choose companies about, you know, I said there's lots of free credits out there and things, but the expression, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Right.
You know, you're going to pay for it many, many, many times over later for making that wrong decision. But at the same time, it may be that a hyperscaler is right for you. So I'm not, you know, advocating for saying Sivo is always going to be the best option. I think there's lots of good cloud providers out there, but it's about making sure it's the right one for your business. And the one thing that we actually did a survey, and we surveyed 1,000 companies that used hyperscale providers, and I think it was 65% used less than 10 services.
Mm-hmm.
So what Sivo caters for is almost like those 10 services, you know, to do really well, those core things that people need, like infrastructures, which could be Kubernetes as well or not. They tend to need, you know, a database. So we have a database offering. They tend to need some form of storage, whether that be object storage or some sort of block storage. You know, we have that offering. We have the networking components that go with it, load balancers and firewalls and those kind of things. You know, and most companies just need that core set of services. It's a basic web app they're hosting. It might be a big, very successful web app, but it's essentially a database and some infrastructure, you know, in that sense. So I think sometimes people buy into the hyperscale narrative of they've got 150 different services. Maybe I might need those one day, and that's why I go to a hyperscaler. Maybe, you know, I'm going to operate in 50 countries. So, you know, one day I'll, you know, need a region hosted in somewhere in Africa or something like that. But, you know, in reality, most companies are not going to need that. Certainly not for a long, long time. They can always go and look at that later. So I think it's important to evaluate upfront what you're actually looking to achieve, but also being aware of the dangers that if you do get locked into a hyperscaler, it is very, very, very hard to get out. But if it's for the right reasons, then fine, go for it.
And one of the good developments that has happened, and maybe this has been via pressure from the EU, is the fact that I think Azure, AWS, and Google have all removed the egress fee if you're migrating off of their platform. So they haven't removed all egress fees, but if you're actually making a migration off, they've removed that fee at least.
The European, I think by 2027, they have to remove that completely, I think by law. In the UK, obviously UK is not part of the EU anymore, slightly different, but so they don't have to remove it in the UK, don't have to remove it in the US and other countries. Also, to kind of defend against that, in the early days of that coming out, they already put announcements out. I can't remember who was first. I think it was Google, then suddenly AWS followed, then Microsoft followed, saying that, you know, we're going to not charge for egress when you leave. But then it was with a load of caveats. It was, you had to move everything off in its entirety. You had to put in a manual request to do this. There was kind of I think some terminology saying it's not necessarily a mandatory thing. It's a discretionary thing as well. And I'm sure, you know, when you phone them up and you kind of say, I'm leaving, they're going to try and entice you back in and, oh, we'll give you some more credits or whatever it might be. So do you ever actually get to leave? I think if it's going to be done properly and, again, giving the power back to the user, leave should be leave. I want to leave. I want to leave today. I don't need to phone anyone. I want to take my data as my data and let me go.
Right.
You know, and that's how it should be.
Ideally, yes. And we don't live in the ideal world, unfortunately.
No, unfortunately not.
Geez, I'm thinking back about the VMware conversation and how disruptive that has to be for small businesses that have not only built their business, but their core skill set all around how to properly manage a VMware infrastructure. And those are skills that are not necessarily transferable or easily transferable to whatever the next platform is going to be. So you're not only tasked with replatforming your technology, you're tasked with retraining your folks or just paying the 6x or 8x that your VMware bill has become. And I think for a lot of people, the easy button in the short term is to just pay the fee and then start planning.
Yeah, that's a good point. And when you think, you know, look at AWS in terms of the certifications you need to learn their platform, you know, sometimes I think it's complex by design and, you know, you have to be certified. And then those certifications that you get are obviously worth something on your resume as well. But actually, by comparison, if you use Sivo, it's very simple and easy to use. So we're always the perspective that you don't necessarily need to have lots of training and extra certifications to become, you know, a cloud engineer on Sivo because we've made it much easier. But I think that's the way, especially, you know, AI coming and things, and there's more abstraction, that complexity can be reduced a lot. I always think about the cloud should be like a, you know, an Apple iPhone or Apple product, especially the iPhone. And, you know, when they first shipped in that, it was the first mobile phone, I think, that was shipped without a manual. because they made it so easy to use and so intuitive that they said you didn't need one. And I think the cloud should, to some degree, be like that. You know, it should be, you know, just to launch some infrastructure or attach some storage or, you know, set some firewall rules up or whatever it might be. It should be fairly trivial to some degree, unless you're going to get into a lot more of the complexities of maybe some deeper networking and things like that. But actually, sometimes even to do the most basic things in hyperscale providers is very difficult and takes time to get your head around their way of doing it in a very particular way. And you have to do certain things before you can do other things and all those kind of things. But I think that's building up proprietary knowledge of that product, isn't it? Which is, like you said about going back to VMware, there's a lot of proprietary knowledge built around that product. So I think for me, again, it's if we get to a place in the future where we have more standard ways of working and standard APIs and standard Terraforms or whatever it might be, the way we spin up infrastructure, then that kind of skill set can be more easily transferred between cloud providers as well. I'm asking for a lot, I know. But I think, again, if that world existed, it would be good for people.
I think so. And I think it would unlock a lot of potential innovation from people who are trying to write applications because it simplifies what they have to deploy and think about. And they can focus on solving a business use case rather than getting down and mogged in the mire of infrastructure and unlimited complexity. I mean, some people will need that level of complexity and access to it, but some people, they just want to get in the car and drive. They don't want to build the car themselves. And having both of those options available, either way, I still know how to drive a car. It's just, how do I want to get to that car? Do I want it delivered to me? Do I want to make it myself? Do I want something in between? And how do I want to take care of that car? And I kind of apply that to, how do I want to deal with my infrastructure? Do I want it to be, you know, fully managed by me, partially managed by somebody else? Regardless, it's still similar enough that if I move to a different mode of operation, it's still the same fundamentals that I'm applying regardless of the place.
Yeah, definitely. And we believe in more that we take some really good defaults for you. You know, out of the box, you get a very good and sane starting point. And we've abstracted that to make that a bit easier. But with our platform as well, if you want to dive a bit deeper and go a bit more into some advanced settings, you get access to those as well, which I think is quite important because you can imagine, especially people who are newer to something like Kubernetes and they're doing it for the first time on AWS, it could be fairly easy to actually make mistakes.
Yeah.
And actually then leave yourself vulnerable, you know, to security risks and things. And it used to be back in the day, isn't it, that all these S3 buckets were just left open, you know, for people just to access and stuff like that. Because rather than put in some sane defaults for people to start from, and then the advanced infrastructure, you know, options to come later if you need them, it's kind of giving you everything right out of the box and saying, you know, even for people who are new, you've got to learn to configure all this stuff. So I think the complexity can actually lead to sort of security weaknesses because, not that, say, AWS is inherently insecure, because they're not, but by the mistakes and misconfigurations that you make, it can become insecure.
Right. So putting those sane defaults in the first place makes a lot of sense. Azure SQL, for example, for the longest time, the default was to give you a publicly accessible endpoint, and your database password didn't have to be overly complex. So you could just have your database hanging out on the internet and someone could just start running, you know, a password cracker against it and probably get it in a trivial amount of time. Now, I'm glad that is no longer the default. Since it is 2025 and it's, you know, AI is in full swing of hype cycle, I have to ask, does AI play any role in this cloud migration, hybrid cloud sort of rebalancing effort people might be going through?
I think it will do. I'm not really seeing much innovation around, you know, to help solve that kind of interoperability between clouds in terms of migration, automation, or anything like that. We have actually partnered CIVO with a company called StackGen recently that who do actually do cloud-to-cloud migrations through infrastructure as code by translating your Terraform from one provider to another provider in an automated fashion. I wouldn't say it's AI, but obviously they're one of the few companies that are really looking for that cloud to cloud migration, because that was always our challenge. You know, most of what we do on a daily basis, bump into clients that are frustrated with hyperscalers and they want to reduce cost or bring that simplicity. And they then look at the whole thing and just say, do you know what? It's just too big a migration. We just can't do it. We're busy with these projects at the moment. We've got a couple of launches going on. My engineers, I can't take them off, those kind of things. So we're very hopeful with this new relationship we developed, announced literally a couple of weeks ago, that we're making that path for cloud-to-cloud migrations much easier using StackGen. So, but I'm sure, you know, we're going to start to see the emergence of AI supporting that as well, which I think is going to be really important maybe for this kind of democratization of cloud services in the future. So definitely hopeful on that one.
Yeah. Do you think the AI hype cycle itself is playing any role in people embracing hybrid cloud a little bit more, especially from a data sovereignty perspective?
It seems to be, yeah. I mean, we have our private cloud products, and we probably talk as much about private cloud now with customers than we do with public cloud. And I mean, that's one of our key advantages as well, that we do have that parity between the services. So we've got a great story there. But certainly, we've just announced that, you know, Kelsey Hightower coming on board as a director for Sivo, and that got announced at our Sivo Navigate conference in San Francisco. And he presented on stage with me around this kind of parity of, you know, the Sivo public cloud with our private cloud. And, you know, he's very passionate about that, because if you are, you know, a country that's not served by a major cloud provider, you're going to have to go to the next nearest region, which might be a few countries away, you know, and then it's not ideal. You've got no sovereignty, but also, you know, the latency and things like that. So you don't really have a choice. You kind of got to maybe roll your own and get a data center and use OpenStack or something. And, you know, for a lot of companies, that's a hell of an undertaking, you know, but we've got that solution where we can literally ship one of our FlexCore appliances and you can launch the equivalent of the Sivo public cloud anywhere in the world. And it's with that parity, the same APIs we use, the same Terraform, you know, cross-plane, all those kind of things that you use, the same suite of products. They come GPU enabled as well as an option. You know, so you can have that parity of a public cloud privately. And I think that's really powerful and something that I think is going to become more and more important and unlocks that really hybrid strategy where, you know, certain workloads are great, you know, for public cloud, others are better for different reasons off the public cloud. But then maybe if you want to move something back, you've got that seamless movement of transferring some stuff to public cloud or vice versa in that way. So I think that's going to play a really important role, because definitely there's a lot of talk, there's a lot of politics going on at the moment, there's a lot of governance happening around sovereignty as well. And it's going to play a bigger and more important part of that, especially in an AI future, I think, in that regard. And data, I think data is becoming more valuable than ever. So that protection of data and that sovereignty of data is very important.
That is some food for thought, for sure. And yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head when it comes to a little bit of political instability isn't helping things in terms of where you want to keep your data.
Yeah.
Wow. So this was a great conversation, Mark. Thank you so much for being a guest today. If people want to follow you, want to learn more about you or what Sivo does, where's a good place for them to land?
I'm on Blue Sky, LinkedIn. And yeah, if you want to reach out to me, it's mark@sivo.com.
All right, great. Thank you so much, Mark, again, for being a guest today on Day 2 DevOps. Thanks once again to our guest, Mark Boost, for appearing on Day 2 DevOps. If you're interested in Sivo, he reminded me that they have a conference coming up in Austin on May 14th. So if that piques your interest, go and check it out. And virtual high fives to you, dear listener, for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future shows, topics, or guests, we would love to hear them. You can hit either of us up on LinkedIn, me or Kyler, or you can send some feedback via packetpushers/FU. FU is for follow-up. You can find me, Ned Bellavance, at nedinthecloud.com, and my amazing but absent co-host, Kyler Middleton, blogging over on letsdodevops.com. We're both very active on LinkedIn as well, so stop by, say hello. Hey, vendors out there, do you have a way cool cloud product that you want to share with our audience of IT professionals? You could become a Day 2 DevOps sponsor. You'll reach several thousands of listeners, all of whom have problems to solve. Maybe your product solves their problem, but they'll never know unless you come on our show and talk about your shiny solution. More information can be found at packetpushers.net/sponsorship. Until next time, just remember that doing DevOps is awesome, and so are you.